This week, the shocking Pennsylvania grand jury report on Catholic clergy sex abuse. This hour, an Iowa bishop responds. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, a conversation with Bishop Richard Pates of the Diocese of Des Moines. Also on the program, analyst Chris Larimer reflects on state fair politics. Over 300 newsrooms, including several in Iowa, speak out against Donald Trump's attacks on the media. A bad report card for Iowa infrastructure. And why did an Iowa forest become a dumping ground for unwanted dogs? Buckle up for your news buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later this hour in our handful of quick conversations to end the news week. Of course, over 300 newsrooms, including several in Iowa. News organizations speaking out against Donald Trump's attacks on the media. We'll hear about that in a few minutes. Also, a bad report card for Iowa infrastructure. And why an Iowa forest became a dumping ground for unwanted dogs. Also, that shocking Pennsylvania grand jury report on Catholic clergy sex abuse will have a response from Bishop Richard Pates of the Diocese of Des Moines. That coming up in just a moment. But let's start off with state fair politics. Iowa has been thumped by escalating tariffs with our major trading partners, China, Mexico, Canada, others around the world. Of course, our state, a leading producer of many products, now caught in the crossfires of this tit-for-tat escalation in tariffs. Iowa is a leading producer of pork, soybeans, corn, milk, eggs, other commodities. That's made this year's Iowa State Fair a hotbed of political discussion about ongoing trade wars. Chris Larimer is with us, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, one of our regular political analysts. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Ben.
So we want to hear some clips from the soapbox speeches at the fair. Of course, the fair known for its politics as well. But let me ask you generally, with the topic I just mentioned, how have the escalating tariffs impacted politics in the state, especially in the ag community, especially in a community that went really heavily in support of Donald Trump?
Well, I think you're seeing the tariff issue move to the top of the list for Democrats in terms of how they're talking about the campaigns and trying to associate any Republican with the Trump administration and the potentially damaging effects on Iowa's economy. I think you're seeing it with the gubernatorial campaign. You're seeing it with the campaign in the 1st Congressional District, both of which are listed as toss-ups. But there's that attempt by Democrats to tie Governor Reynolds and Congressman Blum to the Trump administration and those policies on tariffs as a way to hurt them in November, because we know that the economy is kind of the number one issue when it comes to voting. And so I think you're seeing it move to the top of the list.
Okay. Let's listen to some of those cuts from the soapbox. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds touting her new legislation and positive state rankings at the Iowa State Fair on Tuesday said that her opponent, Democrat Fred Hubble, doesn't agree with a U.S. News and World Report that ranked Iowa as the number one state in the country.
That was a recognition of our people. It was a recognition of our work ethic and our values, and people just like every one of you making a difference in communities all across this state.
Now, Reynolds says she's proud of signing tax code changes, mental health reform, and job training bills into law in her first year as governor. Well, let's hear from her challenger on the soapbox, Fred Hubble. He told state fair goers Saturday that he'd be a governor who would put funding into raising incomes across the state and improving access to education and health care. Hubble says Reynolds and the Republican-led legislature have been cutting services and prioritizing wasteful tax giveaways.
The combination of all those cuts and the funding going the wrong direction with the wrong priority is causing a lot of harm and suffering all across our state.
Okay, so Chris, there we see two competing narratives of how one would like to shape the narrative compared to the other.
Yeah, and they're the narratives that we'd expect and that we have seen over the last few months. It's, you know, Governor Reynolds talking about Fred Hubble in terms of you know, that he doesn't understand everyday Iowans, that his wealth puts him out of touch with the interests of ordinary Iowans, whereas Fred Hubble's talking about, you know, things that Governor Reynolds signed into law or that the legislature has done either this past spring or the previous spring in terms of looking out more for corporate interests rather than the interests of everyday Iowans. I think what we have to remember, though, with the Des Moines Register soapbox, there's still, you have to sort of take it with a grain of salt because you have to think about who the audience is, right? There are potentially about three different kinds of groups that are going to be listening. There are the people who are activists and who are very supportive of the candidate that's up on the soapbox. There are those who are very much against the candidate on the soapbox. And then there are sort of the casual passerbys. And really, those people are walking by, they're taking it in, but it's probably not going to affect their vote for November. That it's not going to really stick with them. To the extent that they're thinking about politics, they're probably thinking about national politics.
Mm-hmm.
And for the rest of the groups that are watching, you know, their minds are made up. I mean, we see it in research and in study after study in political science that the likelihood of voter persuasion is extremely small, whatever the mobilization tactic might be, whether it's door knocking, you know, phone calls, what have you. And so, it's very unlikely that what they're saying on the soapbox is going to persuade voters. It's more likely that it's just going to really energize their base or energize the opposing base.
Interesting. Now, the vice president was also in the state during the week. He rallied Republican voters in Des Moines on Wednesday. This was at a roundtable event sponsored by a pro-tax cut group known as America First Policies. He gave a 30-minute speech approximately to a crowd of 250 or so. He recited what he sees as the accomplishments of the Trump administration, including record tax cuts and a crackdown on undocumented immigrants.
We're removing criminal, illegal immigrants and gangs from our streets in record numbers, and we've already started to build that wall on the southern border of the United States. It's happening.
Okay, Vice President Pence on Wednesday here in Iowa. He also mentioned the president's call for a new space-based branch of the armed services, the Space Force. He predicted a better trade deals for the nation's farmers. He was also at a private fundraiser for the 3rd District Republican Congressman David Young in one of those very competitive congressional races in this state. How much do these visits, Chris, by the vice president or by Donald Trump? He's been here too. Help GOP candidates. I guess it's thought they help quite a bit because we're seeing the vice president and the president here.
Well, again, we're not going to see any voter persuasion by these types of visits. What they do, however, is allow the party to potentially sign up more Republicans who maybe are not as active and maybe don't vote regularly in a midterm election, that they might be motivated to come out to see the vice president or the president because that is a significant event. And then it allows the political party, in this case the Republican Party, to be able to have the contact information of those voters that show up for this type of an event and continue to stay in contact with them for November. So it's more of a mobilization tactic or it's an assist with mobilization and mobilizing voters for November, but it's certainly not going to persuade any voters. But again, it could potentially help with turnout come November when you have these sort of high-profile visits. But it's not the case that the vice president's visit or certainly the president's visit, given their approval numbers, given how polarizing both of those individuals are going to persuade a Democrat or even an independent who leans Democratic to vote the other way.
Mm-hmm. Let's have you focus. We have a few minutes left. Have you focus in on the 3rd District. That's actually where the state fair is located. Democrat Cindy Axne challenging Republican Congressman David Young in that district, including Southwest Iowa, Des Moines. Mm-hmm. She told state fairgoers she's running for Congress because she's unhappy with decisions made in Washington that she says hurts Iowa families. Axne said Washington doesn't, quote, have our back and Iowans deserve better.
Unfortunately, my opponent, Congressman Young, doesn't think that. And as a matter of fact, he's so mired in the ways of Washington that unfortunately he's causing some of these problems.
Now, she accused Young of taking money from corporations, voting for a tax bill that benefits wealthy shareholders. For his part, Republican Congressman David Young told state fairgoers on Thursday he's working to keep the country's economic growth.
There's an economic renaissance going on in Iowa and this country, and we have to make sure that it continues.
Okay. Tell us a little bit more about your thoughts on this third district race there. We have an economy that seems to be in pretty good shape, also here in Iowa, and that's what they're addressing here, right?
Well, and that makes sense. I mean, you think about what helps predict a vote for Congress or a vote for in a midterm election predicts vote choice, and part of it's perceptions of the economy, particularly perceptions of the national economy. So it makes sense that both candidates are talking about that issue. I think what's interesting here, though, is you, in the case of when you think about this third congressional district, we've seen a lot of pollsters move it into either a lean Republican or toss-up category. Mm-hmm. We also have the first congressional district in Iowa, which is clearly in the toss-up category, but you have two very different incumbents running in this case. You have Congressman Young, who's relatively low profile compared to Congressman Blum in the first congressional district. We know that Congressman Blum's part of that House Freedom Caucus, very conservative element within the House of Representatives, compared to Congressman Young, who's not quite as high-profile a candidate. But there's still the attempt, I think, by Sidney Axne and other Democrats to try to link him as arm-in-arm with the Trump administration. And he really hasn't been out there as much. And we don't see his name as often as we do with Congressman Blum and other more conservative members of the House of Representatives. I think what the hope is for Sidney Axne is that there is this real blue wave mm-hmm. in 2018, the kind of blue wave that we saw in 2006. I think at this point it's still too early to tell because we've seen there's the polls on the generic ballot test as far as who you would vote for today if the election were held today, a Democrat or Republican, who would you want to control the House of Representatives? And, you know, in previous weeks that number had given Democrats an advantage of maybe 5 to 7 points, but we've seen that number come down a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so and we've seen the registration numbers in Iowa pretty much holding steady. So I don't think we yet know if this is really going to be that big blue wave that a lot of Democrats are hoping for.
Mm-hmm. But we can say that in the big picture, Democrats from a national perspective, are they counting on any of Iowa's seats to flip into the Democratic column?
Oh, I think they absolutely are. They're certainly looking at the first congressional district as a possibility, and slightly less so, I think, for the third congressional district. We have to remember, yes, it includes Polk County, but as you said, it extends all the way to the southwest corner of the state to include Council Bluffs as well, and that southwest corner of the state is very, very conservative, very Republican in terms of party registration. And so that one's slightly less so, but certainly they're looking at the first congressional district in Iowa as one that's a potential flip.
Okay, Chris Larimer, plenty of politics that we didn't mention, left to talk about, but we've run out of time. Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa, plenty to talk about at a future moment. Chris Larimer, thanks for stepping into the studio.
Always nice to chat with you, Ben. Thanks.
Thank you. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, you heard this week, it was yesterday actually, that over 300 newsrooms around the country joined the call of the Boston Globe, speaking out against President Trump's criticism of the media. All types of community papers, from large metro area dailies to small local weeklies, joined to remind readers in their individual editorials of the value of America's free press. Together, the papers sought to affirm a fundamental American institution of a free press. And joining that affirmation from here in Iowa, listing off a few that I saw, the Des Moines Register, the Ames Tribune, Storm Lake Times, the DeWitt Observer, the Dyersville Commercial, the Manchester Press, the Cascade Pioneer, perhaps also your local paper that I didn't mention in that list. Joining us now to talk about this, Adam Sullivan is a columnist with the Gazette. Welcome to the program, Adam.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us. Steve Barry, a Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter here, also formerly of the University of Iowa, author of Watchdog Journalism, The Art of Investigative Reporting, also co-founder, senior advisor, and former interim executive director, editor of the Iowa Center for
Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism, iowawatch.org.
All right, very good. Thanks for filling that in. Gentlemen, let's talk for a few minutes about this action by so many newsrooms across the country. Adam, your paper, The Gazette, participated in this with an editorial, Trump sows cynicism and distrust in criticizing journalists. Tell us some of the points you made in that piece.
Sure. This is an issue we talked about previously. Obviously, throughout Trump's presidency and before that during the campaign, he's made a number of troubling statements about the press. So for us, it wasn't necessarily really about participating in the national thing. This is something we wanted to write since he made the enemy of the people comment most recently. But you know, another part of it is that we also wanted to provide some nuance. That was one thing that was important to me. So I think reading some of the other editorials from around the country, there was some really good stuff out there, but some of them did go a little bit too far, I think, in making the case. And so one thing that I wanted to make clear in the editorial is that, you know, hostility and political rhetoric didn't start with Trump. But it is unique now because it is being embraced at the executive level. So certainly concerning statements, but we also wanted to make clear that it's not necessarily the hostility we're seeing is not necessarily a Trump issue exclusively.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, the president lashed out at this coordinated publication of hundreds of editorials defending the freedom of the press. These editorials reminding the president that journalists are not the enemy of the people, as he has often said. Here's his response via Twitter. The Boston Globe, this was the initiating paper, right? The Boston Globe, which was sold to the failing New York Times for $1.3 billion or $2.1 billion, was then sold to the Times for $1. Now the Globe is in collusion with other papers on free press. Prove it. That was a tweet from the president Thursday morning. I guess some that I don't understand references. There's Steve Barry. Your thoughts on this action by the press this week and the president's reaction?
Well, I certainly applaud the 350 newspapers who joined in this collaboration. Mr. Trump calling it a collusion. That's his choice of words, but I think we've reached the point where the anti-press rhetoric has become more than just grousing about individual stories and has risen to the level of an all-out attack on the institution of the free press. And it's extended to such a level that I think the press now, as an industry, needs to rethink the idea that we can never collaborate or never get together on a particular particular problem. I can qualify that to some extent, but when you have the entire industry, that is a national issue, and it's at that point that I think the kind of collaboration that we saw with these 350 newspapers is something that's called for.
Mm-hmm. Steve, though, in a way, this action, doesn't it play into the president's claim that the press is conspiring, colluding against him? What do you say to our listeners, some who may feel that the press is being too harsh on this president?
Well, that was precisely the position of the Los Angeles Times, my former newspaper. And again, that is the traditional approach. That is part of the traditional approach for as long as I can remember, when anybody suggests that the press take a proactive stance against wholesale criticism of what it does. And as far as the validity of their comment, well, it's a valid argument, but I dispute it simply because it doesn't matter what the press does. I don't see how the president adding another accusation on top of fake news now to say we're colluding. Is that going to make things any worse than he's already done?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, you know, it just doesn't hold that we can't act because we're afraid of what somebody might say. I think we've been too guilty of that in the past. We can't sit around and determine what's right or wrong because we're afraid of what the president or anybody else may come back and criticize us for. We have to say what we think is right, and that's that.
I wanted to go back to the comment. I think, Adam, you commented on this a moment ago about the atmosphere, and I don't think this began with Trump, the anti-press hostility. Let's go back. Adam, you were there at our Pints in Politics last week. I pulled out a clip from Joyce Russell, IPR State House correspondent. This is a personal experience of one of our longtime reporters, State House correspondent Joyce Russell, talking about the atmosphere that that journalists work in today.
I started realizing a different or experiencing a different attitude to the press well before the Trump era, and it started with the Tea Party era. When it was the first time I went to news conferences or Chuck Grassley events or other events where there was open hostility to me, that I remember leaving a Chuck Grassley event and was just walking away with my gear and minding my own business, and where people were shouting at me, "You better report that fairly. You better get that right." So that was kind of the beginning of it, just kind of this hostility. And then that got really bad during the...
So Tea Party, we're talking 2008, 2009.
And then it was even worse, of course, during the Trump campaign, that we would be, the press would be isolated in a certain area. Well, that's not that unusual. But people would, but Trump would finish speaking and we would be working and writing up our stories, and people would come right up to us and just in your face, "You better get that right. You better be fair in your reporting." So it's definitely a different atmosphere, and certainly public radio is not immune to that.
IPR's Joyce Russell. Adam Sullivan, you were at that event, but comment on this, that the climate was ripe for these types of attacks from the president.
Right. And I would also give one more example. So just a week ago, we had examples. There were alt-right rallies planned around the country, and it turned out there were more Antifa activists, it turned out, in some cases, and they actually physically interfered with journalists, and which is just to demonstrate this isn't all related to Trump. As Joyce said, you know, it predates his presidency. But the big difference, though, is, you know, whether it's the Tea Party people that Joyce is talking about, you know, those people weren't embraced by John McCain and by Mitt Romney. You know, those candidates, the heads of the party at the time didn't egg those people on. And so I think it's different now when we have a president. And, you know, to be clear, I'm a Republican. I've supported several of the things that Trump has done in office. But the way that he talks to the media and the way that he kind of encourages that hostility is different than what we've seen before.
We have just a minute left. To you, Steve Barry, your experience in the press stretches back decades. What do you have to say for those of us whose lives and experience doesn't stretch back so much in terms of what we're seeing from the Trump administration, its relationship with the press, its the Trump administration's demonizing of the press? Does it compare with anything else?
No, not in my experience does it compare at all. Now, needless to say, ever since I first wrote my first story on a controversial issue, I've experienced personally criticism, critiquing, claims that I wrote something inaccurate. I've even received death threats for some stories. And so attacks on the press are nothing new. That's just the fate of any messenger. And we, that's part of the job description. We recognize it, we accept it, and go about our business and do our job. We've always stood by the proposition that the best way to respond to attacks on the press is to do our level best to stay out of the story, not become part of the story, and just to seek the truth and report it, and the truth will eventually win out.
Steve Barry, we have to go. I'm sorry, we're run out of time. Time is unforgiving that way. Steve Barry, thank you so very much. Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter, also executive editor. Director of the Iowa Center for Public Affairs Journalism. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome. Glad to do it.
Thanks, Adam Sullivan of the Gazette. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
More of our News Buzz in just a minute. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Vatican in Rome has responded to the shocking Pennsylvania grand jury report this week on clergy sex abuse. The Vatican said it felt shame and sorrow over the findings that more than 1,000 children had been abused by hundreds of priests over decades, while bishops covered up their crimes. The report documents appalling tales of abusive priests and superiors who turned a blind eye. Here's part of what the Vatican statement read yesterday. The abuses described in the report are criminal and morally reprehensible. Those acts were betrayals of trust that robbed survivors of their dignity and their faith. The church must learn hard lessons from its past, and there should be accountability for both abusers and those who permitted abuse to occur. Victims should know that the Pope is on their side, the statement reads. Those who have suffered are his priority, and the church wants to listen to them to root out this tragic horror that destroys the lives of the innocent. I'm joined now by Bishop Richard Pates. Bishop Pates is the ninth bishop of the Diocese of Des Moines, which includes 80 parishes and in 23 counties in central and southwest Iowa. Bishop Pates, thank you for joining us today.
Okay, very happy to be with you, Ben.
What do you say to Catholics and Iowans in reaction to this horrendous report?
Well, I would make my own the words that you just quoted from the Vatican, that this is a tragedy in terms of the outcome of the hurt that is created for so many young people. And our sympathy is with them. Our pledge of support and prayer for healing is also extended to them. It cannot in any way be excused. We need to take a good hard look at it, see what reform has occurred already, and double down on our efforts. So indeed, it is a tragic problem of great magnitude.
Mm-hmm. Is there any reason to believe that what's been documented extensively in this Pennsylvania grand jury report is not just as pervasive in other states?
Well, I think, that it certainly is reflective of that. And immediately after the initial wave of reports came in 2002, there was a fairly extensive study trying to document, the extent of the abuse. So I think it varies from place to place, like all situations do in terms of, the local culture. So I think it would require some real hard study and documentation and also application of context, what's happened and where it's happened, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I guess I was asking, is there any reason that Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota would be any different than Pennsylvania on a big scale? These are a lot of cases of abuse. Can you point to any differences? Why should Iowa be different than Pennsylvania?
Yeah, okay. Well, I can just speak, from the Diocese of Des Moines and our, history here, which I'm mostly familiar with. We've had some issues and questions and problems, no doubt about it. We take full responsibility for them. But for the information that is available to me, I don't think it's to the same extent. I wouldn't be able necessarily to speak for the other dioceses because of lack of familiarity with their situation, obviously, they had some difficulties up in the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis in the course of the past year. I think that they identified some 400 cases of sexual abuse, and they have close to 825,000 Catholics, and also the extent of the abuse is over 70 years. So all that has to take into relative context, and oftentimes the culture of one diocese is different from that of another.
Help us understand, Bishop Pates, how those in leadership positions in the Catholic Church came to operate by a playbook where those in the leadership protected hundreds of priests with credible claims of abuse against them, credible claims of rape and molestation. How does that happen? How does that become part of the culture?
Well, that's a very good question, I think. And, in some of the papers that I've read, that they say, the protection of the institution comes first, universities, football teams, all of those sorts of things. And unfortunately, the Catholic Church in this instance also. I don't accept it. I think it's very shameful. And, it happened. We have to reform. We have to change. How you try to explain it is difficult. I think perhaps there's some background where they want to protect the institution and some lack of knowledge at a certain point of the extent of the compulsion and, the illness.
Mm-hmm. What happens now? There were significant reforms in 2002 after that Washington Post investigation. What needs to happen now? The Vatican's statement talked about accountability for abusers and those who permitted abuse to occur.
I think that's actually, you know, we've already worked from 2002 so that any report of sexual abuse is reported directly to the police. They take the law enforcement, they take on the investigation. Any person accused of sexual abuse of minors immediately removed from office, and investigation is completed. One strike and you're out. So we had one case of that in the 10 years that I've been here, and it was immediately investigated, found to be credible. We moved on to Rome. That person was laicized for abuse that actually occurred 5 or 10 years even before we were able to fully move on it. We also have a victim assistance advocate here in Des Moines, Sam Porter. And he works for the Polk County Crisis and Advocacy Services. We publish his name widely and also his contact information. And we are served here in the Diocese of Des Moines by an allegation review committee. Mm-hmm. That's 7 individuals, a police chief, a counselor, a civil judge, a lawyer, a teacher, a permanent deacon and priest, and all issues with regard to sexual misconduct and sexual abuse are brought before that committee for a full review and seeking direction and advice. And they've been very effective. So since my time here, they had the one issue of sexual abuse that actually occurred earlier. We worked on it. And I think even they report in Pennsylvania that the numbers are down significantly since 2002. In context, most of the abuse occurred, as I understand it, in the 70s and 80s. We can't justify it, but it also was something that, as the John Jay study indicated, prevalent in our culture. So how you appreciate it, well, we have to root it out. And I think as we express our remorse, we're very, very sad, but we have to have reform. And I think the reform was begun in 2002. I think it's been effective till this date, but we must move forward. We must really root this out completely and take every action possibly. The Vatican has suggested some. Our National Conference of Catholic Bishops have suggested some. But we also must see that it is working, and we have to enforce it even more.
Okay. Bishop Richard Pates, we thank you for your time, 9th Bishop of the Diocese of Des Moines. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben. Appreciate it.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, you certainly heard about that tragedy this week. On Tuesday in Genoa, Italy, that bridge collapsing, killing at least 38 people. Related to that, and what you may not have heard this week, alarming news about our infrastructure here in Iowa. Structurally deficient bridges and poor roads have landed Iowa in the number 9 spot. This is a new ranking of the nation's worst infrastructure. Now, that dismal ranking for Iowa comes from a new index by financial news company 24/7 Wall Street. Here to help us understand the ranking, Aaron Grandquist, co-chair of the Next Iowa Infrastructure Report Card, also project manager at the engineering firm HR Green, Inc., and he joins us from that firm in Cedar Rapids. Aaron, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Ben. It's good to be back with you.
What about Iowa's infrastructure concerns you most when you look at this report and in the context of other reports that have been in the past about Iowa's infrastructure?
Yeah, I certainly saw the recent news about that ranking. I would, however, say that they really only looked at 3 infrastructure categories, so to speak. They looked at roads, bridges, and high-hazard dams. And then I guess the 4th data point being the spending per capita on that the DOT spends. So I don't think it's quite as comprehensive as the one that ASCE has done in the past, both at the national level and at the state level. So even though that ranking is certainly not great, what it kind of does is it takes one of the worst performing categories, which of course is the bridges in Iowa, and I think it unfairly weights that nationwide and just gives us, you know, a poor ranking. I think we actually do a little bit better when you take more categories into consideration.
Mm-hmm. But when we do look at bridges, unlike, well, roads, poorly maintained roads can injure, kill people, cause accidents, but bridges in really a catastrophic way, I guess. That's why, especially with the news this week, we have so much focus on it. Tell us about the condition of Iowa bridges as you see it.
Sure. Of course, the news from Italy was certainly alarming, and that was a big bridge with a lot of users over a waterway. I would say that the similar bridges that are used the most and have the most chance for a catastrophic failure or loss of life if there is a failure, those are in pretty good shape. I mean, those are on your primary road systems. They get a lot of attention and money thrown at them to keep them in a good working order. Really, the reason why the overall bridge score doesn't do great in Iowa is because we've got thousands, or probably not thousands, but hundreds of county-level bridges on farm-to-market roads that get a lot of agricultural vehicles going across them, and those are really old, and they're maintained as well as possible mostly by secondary roads departments of counties, and they just don't have quite as much funding as like the Iowa DOT or cities to address these bridges. So those county rural bridges are really what brings the overall score down.
Mm-hmm. Could a bridge collapse happen here in Iowa?
It certainly could. I don't want to alarm people, but you know they are looked at frequently, and a lot of times embargoes are put on bridges when they've been deemed to be too safe to be able to, you know, adequately handle larger agricultural vehicles or semis. So a lot of times you'll see a sign leading to one of these rural bridges that says, you know, you can't go over this if you're more than 10,000 pounds or whatever. So that's some of the ways of trying to reduce the risk mm-hmm. associated with those bridges. But, you know, we really need to make sure that the funding gets to the county level and the folks that are addressing those bridges so that those can be brought up to an adequate level.
Mm-hmm. Is it the case that our funding, our revenue stream directed toward our infrastructure is just insufficient to keep up with the wear and tear on the bridges, roads, and other infrastructure?
I think it's been that case for many years. As you know, the state of Iowa did increase the gas tax back in 2015, and that has actually increased funding at all levels, including to counties. But there's been such deferred maintenance, decades of deferred maintenance, and so this money, while it's starting to come in, hasn't had a huge effect because it's really only a couple of years old or 3 years old at this point.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, before we go, you mentioned the gas tax. We had that bump in the gas tax to help our infrastructure go through the legislature a couple years ago. That's fairly new. I sure see a lot of construction going on roads and bridges around the state. So we have to just catch up. We have some catching up to do.
Yeah, we do. But I think the Iowa DOT and the various cities and counties that are receiving that additional funding, I think they're doing a great job of making sure that, you know, almost all of that goes towards actual construction, you know, companies and materials going into the actual infrastructure. So we're certainly catching up. It's going to take a little while to get to a higher grade. But what's interesting is we're starting the endeavor of refreshing our infrastructure report card at the state level. So it'd really be interesting to see, once we look at the metrics, how much effect the gas tax has actually had on the grades.
Okay, we'll have to check back. Thank you for your expertise, Aaron Granquist, co-chair of the Next Iowa Infrastructure Report Card, also project manager at the engineering firm HR Green, Inc., from where he joins us in Cedar Rapids. Aaron, thanks again.
Thank you very much, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Why did a south-central Iowa forest become a dumping ground for unwanted dogs? That's a question on many people's minds who regularly read Lynn Ta's reporting at the Des Moines Register. She reported on this case earlier this week and joins us now. Hi, Lynn.
Hello.
Tell us the story. What's going on here? And the location of this forest is not been divulged in your reporting, at least, because the authorities are taking care of it, right?
Right. So because some of these dogs that have been dumped, some of them are feral, many of them are scared and wounded. The shelter that is, or the animal rescue that's helping them out, A. Hines 57 Pet Rescue and Transport, has asked that the identity of the forest not be divulged so people go and perhaps put themselves and the dogs in harm. But so basically kind of what happened was last Friday, A. Hines 57 received a call from a couple hikers who just saw a horde of these dogs just out in the forest. When they went out there, they learned from some people in the area that the it's become known as a place where people dump dogs. And so they estimate that there was at least 30 dogs out there. They were able to rescue 7 of them, but so many of them were wounded and scared, and some have even gone feral since there are generations of dogs now that have been breeding in this forest.
Mm. And just to remind everyone, dumping a dog, a pet like this, is illegal, right?
Yeah, so it's a simple misdemeanor, which is kind of the lowest penalty that you can receive under Iowa's laws. But it is illegal. You can receive a fine with it if law enforcement catch you dumping a dog and abandoning it.
Mm-hmm. So animal authorities alerted what is happening or what has happened with the dogs living in that forest?
Yeah, so A. Heinz 57 was able to save and rescue some of them. They told me that they had purchased 10 Egg McMuffins and were able to get them into some traps. And so those dogs right now are being held at their animal rescue in DeSoto. And so they are giving them medical attention. There's an elderly dog who has a wound in his eye. All of the dogs were just covered in ticks. When you went to the shelter, you could see just dead ticks laying around them. As for the other dogs, I know that they are continuously going out to the forest because it's a long process to try to get their trust in people, especially when they haven't, some of them haven't seen people in a long time. And so they're attempting to kind of tempt them out with food, show them that they're safe, and hopefully they'll be able to rescue them and bring them to a safe place to live at.
Mm-hmm. You said they've been in this forest for a long time. Is there evidence that they've been breeding there? Are there perhaps pups that were actually born in the forest?
So some of the dogs that A. Heinz 57 were able to rescue, you could see in their markings that they look pretty similar. So even though that they're older dogs, their spots are similar. They kind of look like they're from the same breed. So it looks like there's generations of dogs out there. I know that they recently were able to rescue a female dog, which was of particular importance because especially she's been in heat recently, and so other dogs have been swarming around her. And so they searched for puppies around her area. They weren't sure what may have happened to those puppies or if she was dumped after she gave birth, but they are looking actively out there for any puppies right now.
Mm-hmm. Lynn, remind us, if you do not want your dog, if you really can't take care of it, of course you should not dump it, what should you do?
Yeah, so the best thing that you can do is contact your local animal shelter or your local animal rescue league or just animal rescue in general. I know that, you know, especially during this time in the summer, some shelters aren't able to take care of all of the animals. They might be full or they might say, you know, they can't take your pet at this time. But all of them are in networks with each other and they're able to contact other shelters in the area. So just keep trying, keep looking. Just don't dump your dogs. Make sure that they're in a safe place. You know, I think some people may think leaving them out in the forest or out at a farm may be the best or funnest life for them. But in reality, they're domesticated animals, and they need to be somewhere that they're safe and air-conditioned and can get regular food and water.
Mm-hmm. Lynn Ta, thank you for your reporting. Trending news reporter for the Des Moines Register. Always fun to follow your activities and your reporting. Lynn, thanks for this this case today.
Thank you.
And we're going to wind up grooving into the weekend with Mark Simmet, senior music producer, host of Iowa Public Radio Studio One Tracks. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing just well. We've got time for one pick from your big bushel of songs. Do you keep them in bushels? I've always imagined it so.
We could.
Okay, what are we going out on?
And there's a new harvest every week around here. We have Kevin Gordon, who is an acclaimed singer-songwriter in the Americana roots rock field and has a great career going. But for us here in Iowa, we remember him as having attended the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop back in the late 80s, early 90s. He earned a master's degree in poetry, worked with Bo Ramsey back in those days, and eventually started his own band. Interesting writer and a great performer, and he's got a new album out, Kevin Gordon. It's called Tilt and Shine. By the way, he was born in Louisiana. He's now based in Nashville, so gets around.
All right, Kevin Gordon. Let's go out with Kevin Gordon. Thank you so much, Mark Simmet.
You're welcome. This one's called Saint on a Chain.
I grew up right down the road. Never had too far to go. Making it here, your chances slim.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Caitlin Harrop. A big shout out, a big thank you to Lucy McGeehee, her final day today. It's been such a pleasure working with you, Lucy. Thanks for all the hard work. Good luck in the future. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend.
St. Christopher round my neck. Wherever I go, my soul he protects.